Welcome to Intergalactic Relations, a University of Sussex podcast. On this season's podcast, we explore the liberal utopianism of Star Trek: The Next Generation. From the profound optimism of early seasons, mirroring the optimism at the end of the Cold War, to the pessimism that creeps into the show a few years later, as the inhuman results of shock therapy in the former Soviet Union and US misadventure in Somalia showed the limits of that post-Cold War order. We hope you'll learn a little about Star Trek and a little about international relations. Hello again. I'm Dr. Faiz Sheikh, lecturer in international relations at the University of Sussex. I love Star Trek, and I think I've been unfair to Dr. Crusher. I think the character actually oozes calm and chill in a way unmatched by the rest of the crew. Not unlike my co-hosts, Dr. Sarah Bulmer, senior lecturer in politics and international relations at the University of Exeter. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Faiz. And yes, Dr. Crusher is cool as a cucumber in this episode.
And Dr. Dan Watson, consultant researcher on civil wars and peace building. Hi, Dan.
Hello.
Great. For this episode, then, we watched The Drumhead, season 4, episode 21. In this episode, there is an explosion on the Enterprise in the engine, which they suspect sabotage. An investigation starts. They discover later that some enemy of theirs called the Romulans, we'll see them later, maybe. They have the engine schematics. This is a big deal because the Enterprise is the flagship of the Federation. So Starfleet Command, the sort of big bosses in charge of the ship and the organization that they work for, sends an Inquisitor, a witch hunter, who conducts her own investigation, tries to uncover some grand conspiracy. And in the episode, we see, just like in our first podcast episode, Measure of a Man, a lot of courtroom drama, a lot of talking heads. Although I noticed in this episode, they made a pretty good effort to keep cutting to the outside of the ship, flying through space. I watched the Blu-ray version, updated graphics. It looked pretty excellent compared to our season 2 Measure of a Man episode, where they were just inside the whole time. We're first going to discuss what happened in the episode, what we found compelling, infuriating, etc. And then we'll move on to see whether international relations might offer us some way to analyze the show, or whether indeed the show can analyze the world for us. Okay, so what do we have to say about this episode?
I can go first if you like. Please. So this episode is trying to play with the sort of liberalism security debate, isn't it? How much freedom are we willing to sacrifice in order to maintain our security? And for me, I think it's interesting because on the one hand, you can view this as an aberration. Like, this is a perversion of Starfleet universe, where you've just got a rogue element who creates this kind of witch trial. But I think it's actually better read, and I think I can argue that you can read it this way, that it's all about the inherent kind of failures within liberalism itself, and that this is not an aberration, but this is actually part of it. So that's where I ended up at the end of the episode.
That's fantastic. I look forward to getting into that a little later then. For me, I've said this before, certainly amongst ourselves, and to anyone who'll listen, this seems to me a real post 9/11 Patriot Act prevent sort of episode dealing with issues of minorities, at least in part, and how minorities need to demonstrate loyalty to be accepted, the threat that is presumed to come from their very being. It's not that any of these minorities have done anything, but when you start suspecting foul play, it's obviously them guys who look different than you, which, yeah, is something that I hope we'll have a chance to talk about a little later on.
Which is this is crazy, though, isn't it? Because when was this one made? Maybe 1990, perhaps 91?
Yeah, it prefigured quite a lot
so
of
it,
this.
So it's, yeah, it kind of portends all of that stuff, which I guess just goes to show us that these things are kind of cyclical within our, like, history.
Yeah, for me, this, I really like this episode, but I would talk back to, like, McCarthyism and kind of Arthur Miller's The Crucible as as kind of the inspiration for this, but yeah, definitely with a kind of a sort of racialized revamp. Do you know whether, did they ever do anything like this in the original series? Because I think there was, when the Romulans are first revealed in the original series, it's, they're the same, the Vulcaneers, and they're like, Mr. Spock, do you have something to say for yourself? But I don't know if they ever do this type of this level of paranoia and suspicion.
I'm not sure either. My original series knowledge is lacking in that regard.
I'm glad I'm not the only one. I don't watch the original series. I don't like it. I like the films. I like the films.
Voyage Home is my favourite.
Really? Yeah, I've had this debate with my sister's partner.
I've had this debate with Fires. Fires is not a fan of.
I
double dumbass on you.
I can appreciate some aspects of it. Show me to your nuclear vessels. But it's the most fun of the many Star Trek films, that's for sure. Okay, so what else? Ah, Satie. We also have to mention a new character, the Witch Hunter that's brought to the ship, who is a retired admiral who is linked to a previous episode that happened in season 2 called Conspiracy. You don't have to know that episode to understand the context. Simply, there was a conspiracy and she apparently was instrumental in defeating it. So with this new potential sabotage and espionage on the ship, the Starfleet Command brings her out of retirement and sends her to investigate. And she is problematic. I mean, I know she's written to be a borderline villain, but apart from that, it's a pretty strange take on sort of strong female character, isn't it?
It's horrendous. It's horrendous, Fies, because basically she has daddy issues and the whole thing comes back to her daddy issues. And she's also just a complete buzzkill in every way. She's really holier than thou. She thinks that having debates at dinner time with her daddy was like the highlight of her childhood. I mean, it just sounds tedious. She's like the last person you'd invite to a dinner party. Awful, awful woman.
Absolutely.
Well, I liked how she's like flanked by like this sort of, this kind of enforcer, this big swinging dick, I think Sabin. And then this really silent scribe character who doesn't really say anything, but at one point the captain turns around and she's right next to him with her little space iPad.
She's like a stenographer. She's just constantly writing what everyone says.
Yeah.
Absolutely. She shows up with her two lackeys. Yeah, she says her staff, who she's managed to reassemble. She's also, I think, a problematic way to depict career women as well, because she has zero life. She talks about it. I have no friends. I have no family. I don't have a home. I live in transit from one mission to the next. It's like, okay, that's a lot.
I think you're absolutely right, Vise, because if you compare her to Picard is also a career man in that sense. His whole life is basically about Star Trek and he's sacrificed a lot. And they play that in quite a sensitive way. But the Admiral Satie, she's clearly just a completely bonkers, broken woman, and it's all gone wrong, and she's ended up with no one, no family, with no friends, and this is all she has. And then it ends with her having a breakdown at the end. So it's just, like, it's terrible. And that's actually also part of the, like, post-feminism thing that I'm going to keep talking about, because every time women are doing new things in Star Trek, something bad happens. It's like the ones that are allowed to have sex, but then every time they do, something bad happens, and it doesn't happen to the men.
Yeah.
Yeah, we should probably talk about Simon Tarsis as well, who's the other kind of new character in this.
Absolutely.
So he's someone who's appears to be Vulcan or part Vulcan, but as is disclosed later on, there's sort of a tribunal which people are invited to watch, but that's set up by this Admiral Satie. That actually he is a descendant, his granddad was a Romulan, and that he's lied about it on his application, and that's her kind of way into making a mountain out of a molehill, essentially.
We're deep into it now. Can we explain to people what the difference is between a Vulcan and a Romulan and why they should care?
I think the way I understand the difference is they're essentially the same race of people, whereas the Vulcans decided that they were becoming consumed by their passions and emotions, were engaged in too much conflict and factionalism, and decided to follow the path of logic. The Romulans are a kind of an offshoot that never abandoned those passions and decided to run with those, and ended up going to relocating to another part of the galaxy and building a society that has certain characteristics of Vulcan society, but is much more martial in culture, tends to be more kind of secretive, and not necessarily more warlike, but it plays a role as a kind of galactic agitator in the minds of the Federation.
Absolutely. So they're both alien species vis-a-vis our human protagonists, and they both look similar. So this person with Romulan ancestry, Tarsis, can pass as a Vulcan, and the Vulcans are friendly. They've famously, Mr. Spock from the original show was a Vulcan. They're part and parcel of this United Federation of Planets. They're part of this galactic UN, whereas the Romulans are not, and indeed are agitators to that very system. And as it turns out, the explosion was freak accident. So while it was the cause for suspicion, in the end, there was no
foul play. A false positive, almost.
A false positive. Satie, tellingly, doesn't take that as evidence that she's barking up the wrong tree. How does she do that exactly? I forget.
Said it doesn't mean that you don't have a conspiracy,
yes,
isn't it?
Something like that. Exactly. Satie denies that the fact that the explosion was an accident is evidence of a conspiracy by saying, well, in the investigations we have so far, we know that this Simon Tarsis character is lying. The fact that the explosion was an accident doesn't change the fact he's lying about something. So conspiracy on, baby. When in actual fact, he's lying. Lying isn't a crime is one of the things that Picard says, I think.
I'd be really interested to know what happens with Simon Tarsis. I don't think we see him again. Sometimes Star Trek drops back into a character that they've outlined for a particular show. It'd be quite interesting to see what he does. Does he go rogue? Is he rehabilitated? Does Starfleet reorient themselves and learn from this experience?
I think he probably just loses his job and actually has his life destroyed. That's what I think. Because it just reminds me of like state militaries when they were hunting down gay people. And in fact, probably a lot of state militaries are probably still doing that. And like expelling them. It's the same thing.
Picard laments as much to someone who he's confiding in at the time. He says that this guy's career isn't ruined. The last person who shows up who was instrumental, at least in the first third of the episode, is a Klingon exchange officer, Jadan. Klingons being the other famous alien race from the original series and brought back here in The Next Generation. We've talked about Mr. Worf previously, who is a Klingon who serves Starfleet. This is a Klingon who is a scientist on exchange from the Klingon Empire, because the Federation, our protagonists and the Klingons, they have a friendly relationship at this point in time. He is suspicious, and very quickly, within the first minutes of the show, I think they establish that he's the one who stole computer information and passed it on to somebody. And that's the sort of inciting incident. But he claims he had nothing to do with the explosion. And that's why it must be a bigger conspiracy than we think, you know?
Yeah, and he's quite an interesting character, because within we're talking about the Star Trek Cold War kind of analogy, the Klingons are kind of brought on board. There's meant to be a kind of awkward type of alliance that's crafted between the Federation and the Klingons, the Klingon Empire. But he represents a more kind of hardline reactionary element, the kind of backlash to that. So he talks about Klingon blood being diluted. He really has it in for Mr. Worf, who he sort of presents as being kind of a turncoat. He taunts Worf, which Worf doesn't react well to.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is something else that might be worth exploring, maybe not in our discussions today, but thinking about things that Star Trek maybe was ahead of its time for, the Klingons were the USSR in the original 60s version of Star Trek with Kirk and Spock. And in The Next Generation, they become allies, mirroring the end of the Cold War. And then later in Deep Space Nine, sort of the next iteration of Star Trek that comes in the mid to late 90s, this reactionary element that we are noticing here with Jadan becomes ascendant in the Empire, and they break their alliance with the Federation and start a war to reclaim past glory and their warrior spirit and all the rest of it. And again, if they are Russia after the end of the Cold War, and today with Putin and a sort of neo-Soviet agenda, I wonder if Star Trek has something to say about those sort of grand geopolitical changes through the Klingons as a Soviet or Russian analog. We're not going to talk about Deep Space Nine today, but something to think about. Anything else we want to talk about before we start our analysis?
I think we need to talk a bit about how the episode ends, the sort of denouement and Picard's speech, and what happens to Tarsis.
Nice.
So throughout the investigation, Picard starts to become more reflective about his own use of things like Betazoid intuition as a reason for taking actions against people.
Sorry, can we talk about Betazoids there? We talked about Vulcans. What is a Betazoid and why is it a problem?
Betazoids are empaths, so they can either read people's minds or at least feel their feelings, in the case of Troi, because she's half Betazoid. And they come from the planet Betaz. And they're also part of the Federation.
Nice.
So Admiral Sati wants to have her Betazoid right-hand man, actually, she wants to take the advice that she got from her Betazoid right-hand man to actually follow Tarsis around. So there's no evidence against him at that point in terms of sabotage or anything like that. But she wants to do that. And Picard's not happy with that because he's innocent until he's proven guilty. And then he's reflecting on his use of Troi, because he uses Troi and takes on her judgment in his own actions. And there's a bit where he says that maybe he should reevaluate that behaviour. And I like this. I like seeing a bit of reflective Picard. So he's already starting to think about his own kind of behaviour on the ship. And anyway, and in the end, this whole show trial gets more and more ridiculous. They out Tarsis as having a Romulan grandparent, and it's going to like destroy his career. And can I just say, the fact that you can't join Starfleet if you've got a Romulan grandparent is like, how, what? How is that part of a liberal, like, utopia anyway? Like, how is this even a thing? But that's by the by. They never really go there. We just know that he lied on his application, yeah. And that's bad. But, like, what the hell? Anyway, so then they carry on with these big show trials. They start to implicate everyone. And in the end, Picard ends up in the trial being questioned by Sati. And before he's interrogated, he decides to give a statement. And Sati says, you can do that later. And he goes, no, according to rule, blah, blah, clause, whatever, I'm allowed to give a statement. And then, of course, he gives one of his wonderful theatrical kind of speeches about, you know, the value of liberty and that he doesn't like what's going on here. And, you know, that we really need to think again. And then he's questioned. And I'll actually hand to you, Fais, to talk about the questioning, because that's quite a powerful kind of scene that builds up to a crescendo.
Yeah, near the end, my gosh, she, throughout the episode, we know that she doesn't play well with others. She acknowledges this herself and said she was reluctant to work with Picard on this issue, but actually she's come to respect him. She thinks they're going to work well together. So there's been this sort of facade of civility between them, and she seems zealous, but, you know, she's reasonable. She's listening to him. And then she uses all of that against him in this final questioning, where she makes it so personal, using every bit of information she has on him to make him feel uncomfortable. She brings up past trauma of his. She brings up his record as a captain, says that basically he's not very good at his job. Not only that, but the way he does his job is a betrayal of the Federation's values. She's just awful. But in a way that makes sense for the show, I guess, because at this point the mask slips and we are meant to see her as a villain, as the audience. So that's fine. And it has the desired effect, right? We feel we hate her at this point because of the way she's treating Picard, the way she's questioning him.
Yeah, and it's quite interesting, some of her paranoia, because it's actually a lot more reminiscent of the scheming Romulans that she claims to be uprooting. But one of the other things that happens is that another admiral is brought on board the ship to kind of observe this sort of this show trial, which is referred to as a drumhead trial, which is where the name of the episode comes from. And during a particular scene, Picard is able to almost goad her, whether intentionally or not, into having effectively a kind of breakdown after he invokes her father when he's speaking. And this causes her to kind of go off the rails. A lot of personal issues kind of spill out. And this other admiral that's been brought on board to observe proceedings just stands up and walks out. He doesn't say anything at all in the episode. That's his only real contribution.
Yeah, so maybe he, you know, I was saying that Satie uses everything she knows about Picard to get under his skin.
Yeah.
I hadn't considered that Picard's also using what he knows when he purposefully name drops the dad, which he knows she has particular hang-ups with, which creates this outburst, which ends the episode, which ends it in a pretty problematic way, right, Sarah?
Yeah. So she ends up having a complete hysterical woman breakdown because, you know, she's really upset that he's talking about her dad. And then she's almost in, I think she is in tears. And then everybody walks out and the thing's finished. And she's just left, sat there, because clearly this is a woman who has nothing except her broken career and her hysteria. Because she dared to like actually try and do something important with her life. Punished.
Yeah. It's a little bit of a Will Smith moment, you know. You'll take her name out of your mouth. Thank you very much. Yeah, she loses it. I've got in my notes. She screams, "Oh, daddy!" She doesn't actually say that, but it certainly feels like that.
She might as well. Yeah. It's terrible. So terrible.
And that an episode that deals with such serious concepts of liberty and security and freedoms versus the threats that we face, etc., to end with this just, she's overly emotional, therefore that's the end of that, I guess. All the rest of those issues remain unspoken. None of the rest mattered. What matters is she's not a rational individual, therefore we don't have to listen to anything she has to say. That wasn't the core of the episode. The episode wasn't about rationality against sort of irrational emotions, etc., etc. And yet, that's how it resolved. So that's a bit unsatisfying, right? I don't know. Did you feel the same?
I think it is a bit about irrationality versus kind of reason. Uh-huh. Because Picard, later on, when he's talking about reflecting on this and talking about how, you know, we think we've come so far, torture of heretics, burning of witches is all ancient history, you know, but she or someone like us will always be with us. And he then talks about fear. The role of fear in that.
Yeah, he draws the distinction between legitimate suspicion and kind of rampant paranoia.
Yeah, and he talks about this like fearfulness that humans are kind of vulnerable to. So in a way, I think he does try to sort of say, but with our reason and our like liberal rules, we can you know, limit the impact of these passions. But they're always with us, so we have to be constantly vigilant. That's what he says, doesn't he? Constant vigilance. Yeah. So she's the perfect embodiment, in a way, of that crazy... She's a crazy woman.
Mm.
She's probably childless cat lady.
No. If only people were childless cat androids like Friendly Data, then things wouldn't be so bad. Excellent. One last thing before we move on then. Mr. Worf, for those keeping count, he has to be held back twice in this episode from beating somebody up for an affront to his honour. And once, because no one was there to stop him, he actually does just beat the crap out of the scientist for daring to offend his honour. But yeah, he's...
Yeah, but that's okay, because that's two Klingons, and that's what they do, because they're essentially like that, remember?
I see. Oh, dear. Whereas, again, it's ridiculous situations. I think once the court proceeding is in progress, and Satie has to tell him, Mr. Worf, like, don't punch him in the face. it's problematic. What can we say? All right, let's move on then and talk about some of our international relations theories, concepts, analysis that we might leverage on the show, or something that the show might help us better understand I think we've already begun to talk about this question of security and liberty, and I guess that's where we're going. Some of us mentioned McCarthyism and this paranoia during the Cold War within the US domestically, labeling domestic nationalities as communists and holding these grand trials, inquisitions, this public spectacle to ascertain the loyalty of individuals. And that's clearly one thing, one way we might talk about it if we're trying to make those historical parallels. And the other one, as I mentioned, is a sort of post 9/11 Patriot Act sort of dynamic whereby our security has been threatened. The only way to protect ourselves from this insecurity is to temporarily, they say, deny our freedoms, particularly some people's freedoms more than others. Tarsus, Worf, I'm thinking about in particular, who get shafted quite a bit in this episode. What else are we saying?
I think it's quite interesting. It shows how power actually works in systems where they're supposedly kind of safeguarded by different principles. But you can see how some people can basically work outside or weave their way through these kind of rules and procedures, also using their authority to do so. I mean, she and her entourage flout procedures quite a lot, but also use them against others. And this is a good way of somebody amassing power. She's risen to the rank of admiral. And this, to me, shows the way in which fear can be a propellant for certain individuals or interests within these kinds of systems. It bridges, in a way, that kind of internal-external divide that we sometimes discuss in IR.
More on the sort of 2000s comparison and the war on terror. The use of beta Zs, the way they talk about it. I know it preempts and precedes that discourse on enhanced interrogation and waterboarding in the US by some decades, but it sounded so familiar to me. Your use of a beta Z is controversial. Well, no, my use of a beta Z is different from, you know, the way you might use it or something like this. And this was similar when it transpired that the US was engaged in what they called enhanced interrogation, what the international community called torture on suspected terrorists. To me, there was some resonance there. And the fact that Picard admits that, ooh, that is strange. And yeah, I probably should change the way I, quote unquote, use my beta Z, or perhaps engage in enhanced interrogation, was nice. It was comforting, like, oh yes, that's how power should have acted. At a time when, of course, that didn't happen, didn't transpire in our war on terror, where it was, yeah, more of it. Let's have prisons. Let's have extraordinary rendition. There was no reflection there. Power didn't stop and say, you know what, I should reconsider this. But in the show, it does happen. Picard admits, like, yeah, that's problematic. He doesn't say I'll stop doing it. He says I'll reconsider that practice.
I was just going to say that I think what the episode also does well, and, you know, issues that have been explored in IR, is actually that liberty and security aren't necessarily opposites. Well, actually, if we think about the lack of liberty and insecurity, and security for the liberal order that always comes at the expense of other people outside of that order, or even the certain groups within that order. And that's what IR's done an awful lot of work on. And you can see this played out extremely well in this episode.
For me, I think one of the core themes here is the way any system can be corrupted. This is a great example of showing the different like tips and tricks that can be used in order to undermine a system or abuse that system. So one of a few that stood out to me is like the way in which Admiral Satie tries to co-opt people into her campaign. So you mentioned earlier like this thing where she's saying, "I usually don't work well, but with you, Captain, I do work well." And I bet that character's used that line before in this fictional universe to try to kind of manipulate someone into working with her. She does the same with Worf, sort of when she first meets Worf, he walks in the room and there's like, it's something unsaid, but you can tell she's eyeing him with suspicion. And then he becomes, he has to almost prove his worth as a citizen of the Federation, and ends up basically going along with some pretty awful things. Her team, her enforcer also engages in lying. He claims a chemical corrosive was used in sick bay, and that this ended up damaging the engine. Turns out that was complete rubbish, and he knew that. It was just an ordinary technical issue, a malfunction. And there's various instances of like bullying and exploiting, particularly exploiting the low self-worth of Tarsis as well, to kind of make that point. And I think when we touched on this earlier, is the use of irrelevant information to smear people. It's when she sort of brings up Captain Picard's historical use or misuse of the Prime Directive. That's one example. There's a particularly manipulative one with his experience with the Borg. And she says, "Tell me, Captain, have you completely recovered from your experience with the Borg?" And goes on to say, "Just how many of our ships were lost? One wonders how you could sleep at night." she really sort of twists the knife in there just to try to make him look awful.
We didn't say that the reason the Borg is such a effective avenue of attack for Satie is because in the episode that we highlighted last time, to watch if you wanted more on the Borg, Best of Both Worlds, Part 1 and Part 2. Spoiler alert for a 30-year-old show, I guess. Picard becomes a Borg. He becomes assimilated, and they use his knowledge of the Federation to completely decimate hundreds and hundreds of people. She gives the number of how many people in this episode, but I've forgotten, in a battle against the Federation, but the Borg cube just completely wipes the floor with them because they have all of Picard's knowledge. They've assimilated that knowledge into them themselves. And in a way, you know, this is deeply traumatic for Picard. It's something like sexual assault. It's
because of how invasive
it is. Yes, his body was used against him, and et cetera, et cetera. And it wasn't, he had no consent in anything that was happening, used against his will, et cetera, et cetera.
I mean, I think it is, in some ways, it kind of is a kind of sexual assault, isn't it? Because it's about violation of who you are. There is, it's your very sense of selfhood.
This 24th century fictional universe, being assimilated by the Borg is a flipping big deal. So the fact that Satie uses essentially Picard's sexual assault to sort of throw shade on his character sort of shows the lines that she's crossing there, and in the context of the episode and the show.
But the bit that really concerned me about all of this is that, yeah, like the day was saved ultimately, but the day was only saved because she's basically imploded and because another admiral walked out of the room and intervened. Had neither of those things happened, like, then actually this could well have gotten even further out of hand and just carried on proliferating.
I think, actually, Dan, I think that's a really useful way to think about it. And it reminds me of Susan Long's work on perverse institutions and trying to use sort of psychoanalytical understandings of perversion to characterize certain institutions. And the key features of that is, getting people to be accomplices and co-opting them into it, which is, of course, what we see here. It's abusive. It's about instrumentalizing people. It's about taking pleasure from actually targeting particular groups. And it's just all of it. So this is really perverse Starfleet that we're like seeing here. Yeah, and you're right. It's interesting that the resolution of it, I think sometimes as a viewer, you can go, oh, right, order has been restored. Picard's liberal warrior has won the day and it's all fine. But as we know from looking around the world, that doesn't actually happen all that often. Often these things keep becoming a cycle and things get, corruption is the cycle.
Definitely going to check that book out. I haven't read it, but I'm really interested in kind of like organized sadism.
On Worf, I know I always talk about Worf, but always Worf.
Always
but
Worf.
There's something here as well, going back to what I said at the beginning on minorities and the way in which minorities fit in this Federation. Worf is a Klingon. Tarsis is supposedly Vulcan. He dresses as Vulcan, but he's actually Romulan, or at least has some ancestry. And both of them are viewed as suspicious. And this goes back to what some of my colleagues had said when they watched the episode at the University of Sussex, when we watched this at a staff student seminar. My colleague, Dr. Sina Divic, said that what she found fascinating about the episode was the embodiment of the politics of the show here, where no matter how high tech the universe is, the body is analog. There are secrets in the body that we can't know. Those secrets presumably are questions of loyalty, for example. You're a Klingon, really, so therefore, how loyal can you be? You're a Romulan, really, therefore, etc. So
it becomes a means of smuggling out, right? Like exactly.
And in the show itself is actually plays with this, where the method through which the actual espionage takes place with the Klingon exchange officer Jadan is through his body. He's taking certain injections, sort of a metaphor for, not metaphor, analogous with maybe diabetes. He's taking injections every so often. But it turns out that in those injections, he's transmitting data through amino acid sequences, techno, high tech, da 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 da. But nonetheless, it is the body that is transmitting the data, the insecurity here, which I think is rather fascinating and maybe something we can talk about as it essentializes, as we have already noted, with regards to Klingons and the warrior culture. But now anyone who's different is essentialized because the body is different. And is that enough? Is that what we're seeing in the show?
I mean, in a lot of ways, it's just classic liberalism, isn't it? It's like difference and we tolerate it. And that difference between different groups is like essential differences. And then the Federation is the means through which they all use, you know, their combined self-interest and reason to interact together. But their difference is kind of inherent. I mean, that's my understanding of it. And then, of course, we can question that the limit, you know, that this is what liberalism says about itself, that it's about tolerance. But clearly we can see that that's not how it plays out in reality.
One of the things that I also, on this note of kind of institutions being corrupted, it was her decision, Admiral Satie's decision, to make this a public hearing and invite spectators. And like the stated reason that she gives is it isn't good to have closed door proceedings for too long. It invites rumour and speculation, and that's justification. And it's obvious that's not a real justification. Like, it's an instrument of intimidation to put the pressure on, to give herself more power and influence over the dynamics in the ship. I found that that particularly sinister. Yeah, I don't want to take it off on the tangent of just having a rant about security studies. But that being said, what a non-subdiscipline security studies is. It's not all terrible, but it's really not very good.
Yeah, it's this weird thing that like grew up. I did a master's in security studies. So I did the master's in like security studies like heyday when it was broadening and deepening and the thing, it's a thing.
Let's move on now to talk about the liberal utopia of the show. What does this episode show us about this fictional, futuristic, liberal dream?
I think the whole episode is set up around this, because there's that really early conversation between Admiral Satie and Picard in her office, in his office, where she says that her father had taught her that the United Federation of Planets was the most remarkable institution ever conceived. And so she basically serves it. That's her entire purpose. So it's a utopian claim there. But I think that what this shows is actually that within that utopian vision, it's always very fragile and very vulnerable and has the sort of seeds of its own kind of failure within it always. So in that sense, I don't think it's necessarily showing that people like Satie have actually perverted it or corrupted it. I think it's actually showing that these things are always within these utopian visions from the start. And I think that's why Picard talks about the fact that people like her are always with us. That's my reading of it.
They're always with us, waiting for the right environment in which to flourish, or something like this, describing her like a growth.
Yeah. Yeah. And he talks about fear and righteousness being the thing that allows them to flourish.
I like the episode, but I always find myself a bit disappointed by the end, because I didn't have that same reading, and I take it as them individualizing the issues, structural issues. You know, we talked about perverse institutions earlier, but in the episode I feel like they just put all that on the shoulders of Seti, as if it was an individual's problem, and they've unmasked her, and that's it now. We're fine. The institution's fine. When actually, as we pointed out, you know, they're suspicious of Worf. Tarsi's had to lie to begin with on his entry form. He couldn't disclose his Romulan heritage because he would have been rejected, etc. And these things are structural. So I'm not sure. I don't know. Dan, adjudicate.
Oh, shit. I was really hoping you wouldn't ask me to do that. are the explanations mutually incompatible? Can you, or mutually exclusive? Can you have both going on? Particularly as a system grows, adapts, encounters new things, more and more of these kind of inner prejudices might begin to unfurl.
Could be. What do you think, Sarah?
I still think it shows that the law itself is inherently fallible, because they were using the law. They were using logics of the law, logics of security that make sense on their own terms. So I still think that it's a case of these things being fallible, just like the liberal utopia is always vulnerable and fragile and fallible. But I see what you're saying about the fact that it's individualized. It's really convenient for them to have created the ultimate scapegoat, the childless cat woman. I'm assuming she's got a cat now, she has to. You know, it's like J.D. Vance's threat to America, right? She's miserable and she's going to make everyone else miserable and ruin American life. I mean, so she's a very convenient scapegoat for this. So, yeah. The one way of reading it is that, yes, it's just her. She's a crazy, hysterical woman, and they get rid of that rogue element, and all of a sudden everything's restored, and reason is and order is restored.
Yeah, one of the kind of issues with this utopia that is Starfleet is that it doesn't really take into account power imbalances. Someone like Simon Tarsi's has very little power when compared to an admiral that's been brought out of retirement and her minions. That's something that's, you know, like an issue with a lot of liberal conceptions of how, for instance, the market works, in which power is written out. It's all presented as consenting, contracting adults rather than taking into account, well that this person's holding all the cards, or like, you want to rent a property. Well, you could in theory reject any mouldy, like, slumlord-owned flat. But in reality, there's nowhere else. It's either go and live at home or on the streets if you don't want that, because you don't have power in that. And I think that's maybe something that's kind of talked around in Star Trek Next Generation.
If I were a lonely, friendless Star Trek nerd...
You mean if?
Which I am. I would say... The writers purposefully make this about humanity rather than Starfleet as a whole. If the Vulcans were here with their logic heads, then would we have got to this situation? The Vulcans are also part of the Federation. There are other species of aliens who are part of this universe. And if they were present, and indeed they are on many other ships that just happened not to be on this one, this has its own particular makeup. If the Vulcans, for example, were present, then this wouldn't have happened. They would have logicked it out. They would have said, oh, the explosion was an accident. Logic dictates that that's the end of that. And then Picard, in his speech at the end, refers to human history specifically, right? He talks about burning of witches and the killing of heretics and things like this. And the show will do this occasionally for the audience's sake. But in many other examples that I can think of, they'll always throw in, they'll have like three examples from human history which they can expect the audience to understand, and they'll throw in one, you know, super random space-sounding event that happened in the 23rd century to make these people seem like they're in the future, right? Why are they in the 24th century still talking about, you know, our present-day human history? They don't do that in this episode. The examples are only those few human examples from our real history, like the burning of witches, which to me says this is a human issue and about human passions. And again, individualizing it to humans rather than making it a structural issue around the nature of legal systems, liberalism and its dynamic, whereby it maintains security for the in-group at the expense of the lives of the out-group, which is what we're seeing happening right here. That's not on trial. It's humanity's dark passions that are on trial.
Well, I think you tap into something here, which is the kind of way in which Star Trek essentializes pretty much every race in it. Probably humans to the least extent, but you know, this like, oh, this race are the information brokers. These are like, as if everyone is doing the same job in that race. Nothing else needs doing. And you know, like the Klingons we've discussed, Romulans being all shifty and this kind of thing. I think going back to your point, what would have happened had the Vulcans been kind of, you know, pulling the strings? I think that it would have just been even worse. I think they would have been also like really, really edgy around Romulans. I think that, as has been kind of elaborated on in other parts of Star Trek, with Mr. Spock's being half human, half Vulcan, being experiencing prejudice within Vulcan society. Yeah, I think it would have been a nightmare.
Right. And the Vulcans, for all their logic, are still prejudiced. Damn.
But it's interesting because this episode kind of shows, well, actually, you didn't really need to be prejudiced because a lot of the people who were kind of on that kind of that border status, such as Tarsis or Worf, actually are exemplary subjects.
Yeah. I guess on that meta level, the episode then stops being about the minority, stops being about the fear of the other. It's really saying, like, all of that is, well, I don't know that it would say it was illegitimate, but it's saying it's the other, the fear of the other is neither legitimate nor illegitimate, because the actual threat in this situation was the self. And fear, what does Picard say? Fear and righteousness that led to these witch hunts. So in that sense, it does cast the gaze back and make us reflect on ourselves, which, to its credit, I suppose. Great. Anything else on liberal utopia?
So I really want to vent about the iPads that they have in Star Trek. So they figured out that we wouldn't have paper in the future. We would have everything electronic, because clearly we've got all these amazing computers that you can talk to. It's like Alexa, yep, but on steroids, isn't it? Like the Enterprise computer. So they figured that out. But what I don't get is why they treat the iPad like paper. So when Picard is summoned in this episode to go and appear before the committee, the scribe comes along and gives him the letter, i.e. gives him the iPad. And then if you watch in other episodes, they'll have three or four different iPads on their desk with different documents on. So they didn't have the imagination to think about the fact that they would just email, or that you could have one device for multiple documents. This has bugged me, and I really noticed it in this one. That is not a utopian vision. I don't want loads of iPads on my desk.
They're taking the idea of electronic paper, email, and just said, well, just as you have five different letters, you will have five different electronic letters.
Yeah, and now I've told you, see it. It's really annoying.
I used to, there was a lovely meme back in the day when people were fighting over sort of who invented the touchpad first, and there were legal battles between Microsoft and Apple because Microsoft had their like table version of what it was called, and Apple brought out the iPad, and everyone's trying to patent the idea. And then the meme was always these, you know, the Steve Jobs and Bill Gates fighting over their respective tablets, and then Picard with his iPad, Star Trek having done it in sort of 1987, which I always enjoyed. Lovely. Thank you, everyone. That is it for today. Thanks for listening. The next episode we watch will be The Outcast, Season 5, Episode 7. So do give that a watch if you are watching along with us. We will see you in 2 weeks' time to discuss desire, gender, sexuality in that episode. For now, I'll say thank you to Sarah. Thank you to Dan.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Intergalactic Relations. This podcast is made possible by the International Relations Department at the University of Sussex. Please subscribe to keep up with the latest episodes.